Thank you so much. Thank you, everybody, for that beautiful welcome. And thank you so much, Judith, for that beautiful introduction. And I'm very happy to be here today. And I was just learning, as I was chatting with Tom, as we were setting things up here, that this conference has been going for many, many years. It's really very impressive. And what a wonderful thing. So just to say a little at the outset what I'm hoping to do, I'm going to, first of all, talk for about an hour using some slides that I've put together. And then we'll take a break. I gather that's the way you normally do it, take a break after an hour or so, and then we'll have a second part where we might do some meditation and some discussion. So that's kind of the format. So my working title, or my not my working title, my title for this afternoon's lecture is based on the chapter that I gather you know you're working through, Judy Kanato's book, Field of Compassion, and that the chapter for this lecture was on the Kingdom of Heaven. And I've read through that chapter and enjoyed reading it. And so my lecture to you today is sort of a response to the chapter. And I'm going to be reflecting on the idea of the Kingdom of Heaven, but the idea of the Kingdom of Heaven as a way of seeing and a way of being. And so Judy Kanato, in that chapter, she talks about, you know, if we accept that the Kingdom of God is intended to be a present reality, one that is experienced in the here and now, not in an otherworldly location at some other time, what are its characteristics? So that's kind of what I want to explore a little bit. You know, obviously I don't know the answer, but I just want to share with you some ideas that came as I thought about this. And actually, ideas, it's not so much ideas that I'll be sharing with you as stories. I'm going to be sharing a number of stories with you as a response to this question. So I want to introduce another person who's going to be coming into my lecture in different ways this afternoon, and that's this man you see here. His name is John Moriarty. And John Moriarty is an Irish writer, philosopher, poet, mystic. He worked for a number of years as a professor of philosophy in Canada, and then he came back to live in Ireland, and he moved to the west of Ireland, where he worked as a gardener for about 30 years, and during that time he wrote about 6 or 7 amazing books. And he sadly passed away in 2007. But his books are extraordinary. In a way, I feel he's a sort of an undiscovered genius that we'll be hearing more about in years to come. I've got a lot from reading his work. And I wanted to start off sharing with you a first story that I got from John Moriarty. And it's the story of Bran and the Silver Branch. So this is a story of an Irish hero called Bran Mac Fiall in the Celtic. And Bran Mac Fiall was the most renowned warrior of his day. He was always successful in battle. And on this particular evening, he was celebrating in his ring fort in the company of his companions and the bards and the druids, and everybody was sort of celebrating yet another victory. But in the middle of the celebrations, Bran experienced what for him was an unusual experience, which was a very strong yearning and desire to leave the meeting or the celebration where it was all happening, and to go outside. And outside was out into the dark. So he went out, and being a triple ring fort, he went from the inner circle to the middle circle to the outer circle and out into the dark. And at that point, the fort was built on a hillside, and so it immediately plunged down into an even darker valley. And so he was down there in this dark valley all on his own. And let me just read you Moriarty's description of what happened. He writes, out here all on his own for no more than a few hours, he found what he had come to find. The silence in particular, it threatened him in a way no warrior could. Hairline cracks he had never known were in it began to open in his mind. For the first time in his life, he was a beaten man. Surely that his warriors would detect this defeat in him, and that he would in consequence lose his authority over them, he turned for home. Soon the thing coming behind him, he heard a music surely not of this world. More threatening to him than the silence, his fear was that he wouldn't survive it. While he still had the strength to do so, he looked around, and what he saw was a silver branch. And it wasn't that the branch was making the music, it was the music. In its very being, it was the music. Hoping he'd make it, he set his eyes on his house, but then, as if there was mercy in it, the branch fell silent. Or no, it couldn't fall silent. It just wasn't there anymore. So, this silver branch hanging there in the utter darkness, in the silence, except for this music, this extraordinary music of the silver branch. So he went to bed, he went to sleep, but during the night he had a sense there was someone in his room. And he opened his eyes and he looked over in the corner, and there was a woman standing there, surely not of this world. And as he looked at her, she started singing. And she sang this beautiful song, and immediately he recognized the music of the song was the same music that he had heard of the silver branch. It was the same music. So as he listened to this song in the music of the silver branch, she sang to him of the other world where she came from. And she described how beautiful it was. And she invited him to come and visit the other world. And so the next morning, Bran asked his captain to prepare his ships. He prepared three ships. He went down to the shore. He got into one of them. They launched out the three ships out into the sea, with nine warriors in each ship rowing out into this headwind. And then Moriarty writes, after days and nights of rowing into a continuously contrary wind, suddenly silence. And who else could it be but Mananon, Mokleer, the god of the sea, coming over the sea in his four-horse chariot towards them. Drawing to a halt in front of them, Mananon sang to them out over the manes and heads of his horses. And for the third time, the music was the music of the silver branch. So what's happening here is, out of the silence, and remember these waves were crashing towards him, these gray waves were beating towards him, but suddenly the noise of the waves went, was just silence, but out of the silence came this music, and he saw it coming through Mananon, the god of the sea, in his chariot. And this is what Mananon sang. This is what he heard in the music of the silver branch. He said, Bran deems it a marvelous beauty in his boat on the gray sea. While to me, in my chariot from afar, it is a flowery plain on which he rides about. What is a grey sea for the proud skiff in which Bran is? That is a happy plain with a profusion of flowers to me and the chariots of two wheels. While Bran sees the great waves beating across the grey sea, I myself see red-headed flowers without fault. So Bran was listening to this, and as he did so, he realized with a deepening understanding that Mananon's description of what Mananon was seeing when he looked at the grey waves was identical to that of the woman who sang to him the previous night of the other world. the other world he was seeking. And so Moriarty writes, getting the message, so something clicked in his mind at that moment, and getting the message, Bran commanded his captains to turn their ships around. Ahead of them, as they ascended the shingle shore into Ireland, was the singing silver branch. And listening to it, Bran and his men know that Manannan has gifted them with his way of seeing things. He has gifted them with silver branch perception, with original perception, with the kind of perception that had been native to them all along, but that over time had been curfewed by custom and familiarity. Waiting for them at the mouth of the path through the dunes is the woman who sang the 50 quatrains. And Moriarty concludes, it was to another way of seeing their own world, not to another world, that she had invited them. In the person of Bran, we came to know that the blessed other world, or the kingdom of heaven, is a way of perceiving this world. So, how can we come into this way of seeing and this way of being in the world? And this brings me to another story, and this is a story that will be more familiar to many of you. And that's the story of Gautama Siddhartha, who became the Buddha, and of the story of his enlightenment, the story of his waking up to understanding and seeing the nature of reality. So the story goes that, and I won't go into the story of the life of Gautama Siddhartha, but that having been on the road for many years, having practiced as an ascetic, having practiced for many, many hours and days and years, deep meditation practice, Gautama Siddhartha, this young prince who had left a life of plenty, and gone on the road in his spiritual yearning and his spiritual search, eventually made his way into the forest. And in the forest, he came to a particular tree. And we're told it's a Bodhi tree or a Pipala tree. And we're told that he sat under that Bodhi tree. He was 35 years old at the time. And that he sat under that Bodhi tree fasting for 49 days. And that his enlightenment came on the final night of that long fast. And Gautama came through that experience as the Buddha, as the awakened one. And he went on to live to be into his 80s. So he lived for almost 50 years after that experience as a great teacher, as he was. But what went on under the Bodhi tree? And I want to share with you just a little personal reflection that I wrote thinking about that night, the last night of those 45 nights under the Bodhi tree, the night of his enlightenment. And just to say before I read this that I had heard the story that the Cherokee Indians, the way that the Cherokee, one of the ways the Cherokee do vision quest is that they go out and they walk in nature until they find a tree that really they know is the right tree. They just know that in their heart, in their spirit. They ask permission to sit with that tree, to sit under that tree for 24 hours fasting, from sunset one night until sunset the following night. And they receive whatever they receive. And very much in the sense of receiving from the tree that they're sitting with. So as I heard that story, and as I thought of Gautama sitting all this time under the tree, you know, 45 days in the forest, I hadn't heard anybody really reflecting on the part of the tree, the part the tree played in his enlightenment. So that's what I kind of played with a little bit in this reflection, which I'll now read. So Gautama Siddhartha had been on the road for many years. By now he was 35 years old. During this time he learned many things, including how to calm and watch his mind. He'd noticed a yearning in his heart. He did not know what this was for. He only knew what it was not for, and so he continued on the road. Gradually, the yearning emerged as a question, as a tree emerges from the ground. And so he sought out a tree and sat under it with his question, "What is suffering, and what can I do to relieve suffering?" That was the question that brought Gautama into the forest that night. That was the question he was looking for an answer for. What is suffering, and what can I do to relieve suffering? Later, Gautama would be known as one of the world's great spiritual teachers, and so he is. But he's also one of the world's great healers, and here is how that came about. That evening, he went into the forest alone. He wandered through the forest until he recognized the tree that was waiting for him. He sat with his back to the bark of the tree as the last light of the day left the forest and all was dark. What is suffering, and what can I do to alleviate suffering? He meditated and prayed in this way all through the night and all through the following day and the following night and the following day and for 45 days and nights, fasting all the while. During this time, his mind calmed and cleared like a still pool. There was nothing to be done but listen and notice and wait. As tree breathed out, Gautama breathed in. As Gautama breathed out, tree breathed in, the one enlivening the other. And Gautama allowed himself to be carried in this flow. Someone gently called his name. Suyata was there, offering a bowl of rice. Her face was full of kindness. He allowed her kindness to nourish him. In deepening gratitude, he surrendered all to the luminous, knowing flow and realized that he was being known as fully as he was knowing, and that he and the tree were knowing each other into their particular embodied otherness, from one moment to the next to the next. Always moving, always changing, always flowing, and that this dance was part of the dance that was the forest, and the dance that was the neighboring village, and on, flowing in and out of each other, as luminous ripples on a pond dance on the bark of a nearby tree. He knew that he and the tree were not separate, that to think in this way was the beginning of suffering. But healing was not as simple as thinking that he and the tree were one. No, the tree was tree. The tree was tree, and not just any tree, but this particular papala tree with its broken branch here and the spots on that leaf there. And he was human, and not just any human, but this one whose mouth was dry and whose heart was moist with a rising joy. Healing was knowing that tree was tree and Gautama was Gautama, but that they were not separate. They were tree and Gautama because of their very connectedness. This tree was this tree because this human was this human in an interflowing becoming of togetherness. Tree had been awake all along. Now Gautama opened his eyes as Buddha, and the forest was filled with light. So one of the teachers that I've learned so much about Buddhism from is Joanna Macy, the now 84-year-old environmental activist and engaged Buddhist, and still very much going strong in her 84th year. She wrote a book which was actually the basis of her dissertation. And her dissertation was on mutual causality. And mutual causality, or dependent co-arising, was the essential insight of the Buddha on the night of his enlightenment. And so in Pali, the word is paticca samuppada, as you see here. And let me just read you what Joanna Macy has to say about this. That it was then, in the crucible of his unwavering attention, then being the night of his awakening, that the realization of dependent co-arising swept over him. the process nature of reality became clear. He beheld the flowing interaction of all things as they arise, as they provide occasion and context for each other's emergence and subsiding. All aspects of our world and all factors of our lives subsist, he saw, in a dynamic web of interdependence. But these currents of relationship are not visible. To the physical eye, we look like separate projects walking around in separate bodies. That was his essential insight, the essential insight of the interconnectedness of all reality and how different aspects of reality are constantly interweaving and interacting and influencing and affecting each other into new iterations of themselves. And following that, in his very first sutra or teaching after his enlightenment, he talked about what became known as the Four Noble Truths. The truth of suffering, the truth of the causation of suffering, the truth of the cessation of suffering, that suffering can cease, and the truth to the path to the cessation of suffering. So you see, the question that brought him into the forest that night was, what is suffering? And the Four Noble Truths, in a way, were the answer that he came out with. And as Macy summarizes this, he saw that suffering was how we create our own bondage, our suffering, by reifying and clinging to what is by nature contingent and transient. That everything is interweaving, everything is fluid, everything is dynamic. But because we want to try and fix things and keep them solid and separate and control things, that is the beginning of suffering. So being caused in this way, our suffering is not endemic, it's not inevitable, it can cease. The causal play can be reversed. Suffering can cease, there is a path to suffering, and this is achieved by seeing the true nature of phenomena, which is their radical interdependence. This is made possible by cleansing perception through meditation and moral conduct, or what the Buddha called the Eightfold Path. So, I just want to, we're still exploring this way of seeing and this way of being that that I'm suggesting, you know, kind of speak to this idea of the kingdom of heaven, that speak to the idea of silver branch perception. And we're now talking about this idea of paticca samuppada, or dependent co-arising, and the process nature of reality. But one of the implications of this way of seeing reality as process rather than how we traditionally usually see it is that it has pretty radical implications for how we understand the nature of the self. So within the conventional way of seeing the self is like a particle or like a billiard ball. It's separate, it's solid, it's distinct, and it's got a kind of permanence to it, you know. And so there we are alongside lots of other billiard balls, and we each have our color, and we each have our scratches, and we each have our numbers, and we each have our characteristics that make us who we are. And how reality happens is that these distinct particles, in a very linear way, kind of bump into each other, and A causes B causes C. That's kind of called linear causality. Well, what the Buddha saw, the inside of the Buddha, it was what he called anatta. And anatta means no self. And that's why you might have heard, you know, that Buddhists talk about no self. And some people say, well, you know, that doesn't make any sense because here I am. And how can no self be the nature of the self? But let's just explore that a little bit. Because as I understand it, what the Buddha is talking about here is a sense of self, but it's not a particular sense, it's not a particle sense of self, it's a wave sense of self. It's self like a wave. And if we were to do a little cross section through one of those waves, it would look like this: that the self isn't permanent and solid, that it's porous, and that causes and conditions and influences are constantly affecting it and moving through in this kind of fluid movement. So So here we have waves from different sets of ripples, and they're overlapping and they're interweaving. And that kind of, you know, from above might look something like this. And as the waves come together, they co-arise into forming a new wave, a new aspect of reality. So that's co-arising or interactive, dependent co-arising, mutually conditioning, and radically interdependent. So what I understand the Buddha to say, and Buddhist scholars who I've discussed this with don't disagree, is that anatta does not mean no self in a nihilistic sense, but anatta means no solid, permanent, separate self. There is a self, but it's a self that is interacting and interweaving. And that's what I kind of tried to play with in that story of Gautama and the tree. That the tree was the tree and Gautama was Gautama, and because they were also had this sort of interaction, the one to the other and back and forth, that was making that doesn't lead to sameness or kind of some kind of bland unity. It leads to diversity, it leads to difference, it leads to particularity. So that tree was its particular self, and Gautama was his particular human self because of their interaction. And so there's very much self, and there's very much distinctiveness and particularity, but it's just not solid and permanent and separate, like we tend to think. And because we tend to think that way and cling to that way of seeing, Gautama says, that causes a lot of suffering. But if we can come into this other way of seeing, which I think speaks to Silver Branch perception, it also is the way out of suffering that Gautama saw on that occasion. So, sorry, some of the formatting in the slides has got a little out of kilter here. But I'm going to move now to yet another story and another way of seeing. So we're kind of walking around the same question and looking at it from many different angles. So here is a phrase, a Lakota phrase from the Lakota Indians. Metaquiasan is how it's pronounced. Metaquiasan. And Metaquiasan means all my relations. And this is a prayer, and it's also a worldview. And before, at the start of every Indian ceremony, this prayer is uttered. As you enter the sweat lodge, everybody entering the sweat lodge says Metaquiasan. You're doing it not just for your sake, you're doing it for all your relations. So this lady here, her name is Leslie Gray, and she's a Native American psychologist, and she practices up in the Bay Area. And I've had an opportunity to meet her and interview her. And she reflecting on this idea of Metaquiasan, or all my relations, she writes, when White Buffalo Woman, now this is another story that I'm not going to go into now, but the story of White Buffalo Woman is the story of how the sacred pipe, and indeed the sacred ceremonies of the Sioux, or the Lakota people, were brought to them by White Buffalo Woman. She writes, when White Buffalo Woman brought the sacred pipe to the people, she said something very interesting. She said, with this pipe, you pray for and with everything. Almost every religion has the idea of praying for something or someone. But the idea that when you use this pipe, the stem of which represents growing things, the wooden stem, the bowl of which represents the human beings, its red clay, and the feathers, the wingeds, and the smoke, the air, that when you pray with this, you pray with everything and for everything. Somehow what she's saying is what she's saying there speaks to two different worldviews. So here we're coming back to ways of seeing. That of the Indian world and that of the Euro-American world. What is going on in these worldviews that clashes so much? It seems that the Western worldview comes from a framework in which one sees humans as waiting here to go to a far better place, heaven elsewhere. Whereas the Indian worldview, in one way or another, is this is paradise. this is sacred, and I am part of it, not separate from it. As a project, she says, one of my students, who is Navajo, went back to the reservation to interview her grandmother. And she asked her grandmother if she could remember any old Navajo insults. What's a really insulting thing to say in the old way? The grandmother thought for a really long time, and then she said, well, it would be translated as, he acts as if he has no relatives. That's the worst insult possible, that you're disconnected, that you're separate, that you're isolated. That's the greatest suffering. So that brings me to another story, and this is a story that comes from the Blackfoot Indians, who, like the Sioux Indians, were Plains Indians, and so they relied their whole life, not just their lifestyle, but their lives depended on the buffalo, the bison, the great bison herds that wandered the prairies. And a time came when the buffalo withdrew, and there was a great famine among the Blackfoot. And this is another story that I heard told by John Moriarty, and so I'll go back and forth into his words as I tell the story. So the famine has come, the animals have gone, and the people are starving. And really, the old people and the young children are sick and, you know, in danger of dying, particularly because they're so vulnerable. So one night, as though she was being dreamed, a young woman whose name was Gets Up Off the Teepee Floor rose up out of her sleep, walked through the door flap, climbed the rock wall, and continued out into the prairies. Seeing a herd of buffalo, it wasn't so much that she called out as that she heard herself as if in a dream calling out, "If you will come and be food to the people, I will marry the chief bull among you." And to her astonishment, it happened. The buffalo once again began to offer themselves as food to the people. But in the midst of all the rejoicing, a great bull buffalo came forward and demanded that Gets Up Off the Teepee Floor come with him. She did, and they walked off together into the prairies. When the girl's father realized she was missing, he went looking for her. He sensed her presence near the waterhole, and he went to the waterhole to see if she'd come there and he could meet up with her and persuade her to return home with him. But instead what happened is some buffalo came to drink, and they drank from the waterhole. They smelt a human. They went back and they told the great bull. And so the great bull and the herd all returned to the waterhole. Finding the man there, the great bull hooked him and tossed him from horned head to horned head he tossed, and soon bits and pieces of him were falling to the ground, the huge hooves trampling them in the mud. So the girl's father was killed. When the young girl arrived on the scene, she realized what had happened, and she was devastated. She asked Magpie to help her find her father's remains. After some time, Magpie, picking around in the dirt, came back with just a tiny little piece of a vertebrae, all that remained of her father. So placing it on the earth, the girl covered the bone with her buffalo robe, and sinking into herself, she began to sing an old, slow, sacred song. From deeper and deeper and deeper within herself she sang. From below sleep she sang. From below trance she sang. And she went down below her identity as a person, even deeper than her personal identity, below her identity as a Blackfoot Indian. She went down to those roots or depths within herself that we have in common with the mountains and the stars, that we have in common with the oceans, that we have in common with all life on earth, that we have in common with the whole universe. And she was down there chanting. And as she chanted, it was as though the whole universe was chanting with her. She was down there a long time, but finally she emerged. And she came back into a sense of herself and into her identity, into her hands and into her hair, and into the Blackfoot Indian she was. And then gets up off the teepee floor, pulled back the buffalo robe, and as she did, her father stood up. And as they stood there together, the father and the daughter, the buffalo began to dance. And this is called, the story is called the buffalo dance. And Moriarty's description of the dance is very beautiful. He writes, "Like the shadows of clouds on mountains on a moonlit night, the buffalo danced, sang their buffalo song, and danced their buffalo dance. And after a long time looking at them and listening to them, the man and his daughter let go of their reserve, and like an otter slipping into water, they slipped into the world, and to their great joy they were able for the world. As buffalo are able for the world, as grass is able for the world. As stars are able for it, they were able for it. Not as they wanted it to be, but just as it is. And what matter if a cougar screeched? And what matter now if an avalanche carried them away? Able for life, they were more able for death. At one with the buffalo in their song and in their dance. And that was it. Being able for things as they are. Now tonight, that was their religion. The religion of mountains and stars as they are. The religion of the universe as it is." And reflecting on this story, and just coming back one last time to Moriarty, Moriarty writes, "Gets up off the teepee floor, did what her name suggests. Rising from tribal prostration and near extinction, she went out and she stood in the horned rift between humans, the human and the animal. And holding her nerve there, she suffered a reversal of the fall into us and them awareness, back into aboriginal we awareness. In this, she saved the world." So it's that idea that silver branch perception, that paticca samuppada or dependent co-arising, another way of describing that is what Moriarty calls we awareness. And that suffering is about us and them awareness that goes with the separateness that we talked about earlier. And coming back into that awareness, not conceptually, but experientially, coming back into that awareness, in this she saved the world. And so this Native American or Indian view of our world as paradise, that we're not separate from, that we're an intimate dynamic part of, that everything is our relative, that everything is family. Jeanette Armstrong writes beautifully about this when she says, "We are the land. The land is part of us in a way that many of us don't understand. We think of the land as being an extension of ourselves. We Indians," she writes. "And we think of the way that the land is inside of us. And so when I walk on the land, when I visit the land, one of the things that happens is that my body recognizes being part of the land. And when you feel that, when you're out there and your body feels it, and your blood feels it, and your mind feels it, and every part of your being feels the sun and the wind and the air, and all the beings around you, I understand my land, and I understand what my land requires of me, and how my land loves me as a result of that requirement being continuously fulfilled by me, by my children, by my grandchildren, and how I must then be responsible for that. The land teaches us over generation upon generation upon generation how we should be on the land. In other words, the land itself asks us to be in a certain way in order for us and it to be happy. And that to me is what indigenous and indigeneity means." we are the land. It's not that we love the land, but coming to a place where we know that the land loves us. So all my relations is also the insight that all is relationship. Is also the insight that the Greek philosopher Heraclitus summarized as all is flow. All is flow. An insight that is being supported and corroborated by modern science, and particularly by quantum mechanics and the new sciences, that all is flow. So if all is flow, how can we come into this flow? And that's what I want to reflect on in the final part of my talk. Before I do, I want to share one last story with you. And the last story is a story that was brought back to Europe from China by Richard Wilhelm, who also brought back from China. He was a sinologist and a minister who lived for many years in China. And then he brought back, when he came back to Europe, he brought back with him the I Ching, or the Book of Changes, which some of you may be familiar with. And he also brought the story of the rainmaker of Kiao Chao. And the story of the rainmaker of Kiao Chao is of this awful drought, a little reminiscent of what we're living with these days, although thankfully we've had a little respite, and maybe a little more respite in the next day or so. But there was this desperate drought, and it had gone to the stage where not only the crops had died, but the animals were dying, and the people were sick, and had tried everything, everything that was humanly possible. But, you know, no end was in sight. So they remembered hearing of a rainmaker from the neighboring county to the north, Kiao Chao. And so they sent an invitation and invited the rainmaker to come and visit them and help them. And so after some days, the rainmaker who had traveled arrived. And he was welcomed by the people in the village, among whom Wilhelm was. He was staying there at the time. And he describes how the look on the rainmaker's face was one of, as he was being welcomed, he looked kind of like he was sniffing the air, and he looked a bit like he didn't like what he was smelling. He was smelling a bad smell. And so his host asked him, "What's the matter?" And he said, "Where I come from, the people are in Tao. The people are in order. The people are in harmony with the deepest rhythms and flows of nature. And because the people are in Tao, the weather is also in Tao. But now that I arrive here, I can smell it in the air. The people here are not in Tao." And so he said, "That's affecting me. So I need to be on my own." And so being on his own, he said, I need a little hut where I can be on my own. And I need you to bring my food and just leave it outside the door and I'll collect it." And so they did that. And for 3 days and three nights, the rainmaker stayed in the little cottage that they'd given him. And they left the bowl of food, and they came back and collected the empty bowl of food. And it just day two, day three rolled on, and nothing else seemed to be happening. But on the morning of day four, let me just see. On the morning of day four, there was a light mist, like a kind of almost like this kind of marine layer that comes in here. And by the late morning, it was a light rain. And by noon, it was a heavy rain. And by early afternoon, it was snowing. And so the question comes up, what happened in there? You know, what was the rainmaker doing that actually affected the weather in this way, seemingly? And so as the snowflakes were falling, the door of the cottage opened and the little rainmaker came out, and everybody rushed up towards him. And Wilhelm asked him, "They call you the rainmaker. Tell us how you made it snow. How did you make it happen?" Wilhelm asked him. And the rainmaker replied, slightly irritated. I didn't make it snow. I'm not responsible for it. Well, what have you done in there these past 3 days? Wilhelm asked him. Oh, I can explain that. And so once again he said that where I come from, where things are, I come from another country where things are in order. Here they're out of order. They're not as they should be by the ordinance of heaven. Therefore, the whole country is not in Tao, as in deep harmony. And I also am not in the natural order of things when I am in a disordered country. So I had to wait in there until I was back in Tao, and then naturally the rain came. And that's what he was doing. He was there until once again he knew, he sensed he was back in Tao, and then the right thing happened. The rain came. So coming into the flow, how can we come into the flow, is also asking the question, how can we come into Tao? Or in the words of the poet Mary Oliver, from her poem Wild Geese, how can we find our place in the family of things? And I want to suggest, just in the final few minutes, but I wanted to suggest to you that at least one way into the flow, into the process nature of reality, which can release us from suffering, which can bring healing, is through deep nature connection. And this may be through inner or outer. And deep inner nature connection is really where we come to through our inner practice, through our whatever our inner practice of meditation or prayer is. And just one of those I want to reflect on very briefly with you is the practice of mindfulness of breathing, which is one of the central Buddhist meditation practices. But as I emphasized in the second bullet, you know, it's for each of us to find our own path into the flow. And this is a beautiful little book on mindfulness of breathing. And actually, the foreword of this book is written by Santokoro Bhikkhu. And here is what he says about mindfulness with breathing, which is the Pali term is anapanasati. So anapanasati, which means mindfulness with the in-breath and out-breath, is the system of meditation often practiced and most taught by Buddha Gautama. Indeed, he's said to have attained enlightenment using this very method. So this he taught many, many different types of meditation practice, but this is the method he taught most frequently, mindfulness with breathing. And this is the method he was practicing that night under the Bodhi tree. In practicing mindfulness upon and through breathing, we learn to relax the body, to calm the mind, and we discover the fundamental reality of human existence, that all is flow, and learn to live our lives in harmony with that reality. So, and I just want to share one other paragraph from Santokoro Bhikkhu, where he talks about how mindfulness with breathing, and I think this can go, this really applies to other types of meditation, such as centering prayer, for example, but can be a process of gradually more and more radically letting go, letting go, letting go, surrender, surrender, surrender. We begin by letting go of our coarse attachments, attachments to the body, to aches and pains, attachments to agitation and impatience, to boredom and laziness, attachments to external disturbances and petty annoyances. So that's the first coarse attachments, the first thing we let go of. Then we find ourselves becoming attached to more subtle things, such as happy feelings or feelings of bliss. Once we let go of these, we discover attachments to higher, brighter, clearer, more refined states of awareness. Letting go of these, we begin to have insight into reality, and so we become attached to our insight into reality. Finally, we learn to let go of everything. In this way, anapanasati is a systematic method of successfully letting go of more and more subtle attachments until there is no attachment left at all. Because attachment is what causes suffering. Attachment is what leads to our reifying, our making real and solid and permanent what is by nature fluid and flowing and dynamic. And the Indian mystic Kabir has a beautiful line where he says, "Something inside me has reached the place where the world is breathing. Something inside me has reached the place where the world is breathing." That's where mindfulness or breathing can bring us to. So in attending to our breath, in that very simple process of paying attention to the sensations of our breath, we are tending the world. And then just a couple of words about deep outer nature connection. And I want to introduce to you very briefly a method of outer nature connection or deep nature connection practiced outside in the outdoors that I have found really wonderful. And it's called backyard bird language. But we each, once again, have to find our own path if we're so inclined. And just backyard bird language was introduced to me and articulated by John Young, who you see here. I just picked up this book of his about 6 years ago now, called What the Robin Knows, How Birds Reveal the Secrets of the Natural World. And he just talks about just how outside our door, all around us, is this field of ancient intelligence. A field of intelligence that we've become separate from, probably about 10,000 years ago, when we kind of left our hunter-gatherer way of life and, you know, started agriculture, started the whole trajectory that's led us to where we currently are. But part of what we have sacrificed for all the advantages of that evolution, if you like, part of what we have sacrificed is one, that experience of interconnectedness that was there in those days, and that certain indigenous worldviews still articulated, as we just heard, talking about we are the land, all is relation. That was how we all were living up to 10,000 years ago. That is how we all experienced. And also that when we are in that reality of being dynamically connected to the natural world, it awakens other intelligences within us that we carry within us genetically, but they're latent and they're not being called on because we don't need them, because we're not living in a hunter-gatherer world anymore. But those kind of intelligences aren't just about catching prey, aren't just about extreme survival. They're that experience of interconnectedness that I'm talking about. They're what John Young talks about. He's spent a lot of time with the San Bushmen in the Kalahari. He talks about the quiet mind, this state that, you know, great meditation practitioners reach after many, many years. That these folks who are just totally in tune with nature come into this quiet mind. And so here he's quoting a San Bushman talking about that process. And the process is paying attention through our senses to what's going on around us. It's not about recognizing birds or understanding what they're saying with their bird calls. It's really about paying attention to birds, paying attention to bird behavior. And I encourage you, if you're even slightly interested, to look into his work more. But quoting the San Bushman, he writes, "If one day I see a small bird and I recognize it," this is a San Bushman talking, remember, "a thin thread will form between me and that bird. If I just see the bird but don't recognize it, there's no thin thread. If I go out tomorrow and I see and really recognize the same individual small bird again, the thread will thicken and strengthen just a little. And every time I see and recognize that bird, the thread strengthens. Eventually it grows into a string, then a cord, and finally a rope. We make ropes with all aspects of creation in this way, through paying attention, through recognizing." And how do we know if we're there? How do we know what are some of the symptoms, if you like, are some of the markers that we know that we have arrived, or we're kind of stepping into this more process view of reality? Well, we'll know in our experience, an experience of spaciousness, of effortlessness, of luminosity, of quiescence, of peace, of open-heartedness, kind of a bubbling up sense of gratitude, a sense of being wide awake, of being more alive than we felt for a long time, and of knowing how connected we are. And we begin to notice synchronicities happening much more frequently. So as I finish, I just want to share one last reflection, and that is, you know, deep nature connection, coming into the flow, for what and for whom? Is it just for ourselves? Is it just so we feel more at peace, more connected, more alive, which are, of course, wonderful things, and things that we all want for ourselves and for our loved ones? But another fruit of coming into the flow through deep connection with nature, with ourselves and with others, is that it awakens our caretaker spirit. Because as we come into deep connection, we come into compassion. We come into a sense of feeling with, as well as knowing with. In deep connection, we experience compassion and we feel moved to act, to do what we can for the ones we love. And we notice that our primary motivation now is a longing to act, to relieve the suffering and promote the well-being and the welfare of all our relations and our ailing world. And so I finish with this quote, which is at the start of that chapter on the kingdom of God in Judy Kanato's Fields of Compassion. One of the three epigrams at the beginning is by Albert Schweitzer. And he writes, "As for humankind today, the realization of the kingdom of God here on earth has become a matter of survival or extinction." It's not just about our sanctification or our wellness. It's about the wellness and the survival of our world. Thank you.